Hi, I'm Carl Randall, and welcome back to another episode of Frontline Security. Now, with me today is someone I'm sure many of you will recognize. It's Mark Robinson, or one half of the Bouncer Bros. And today, we're going to be talking all about his journey in the security industry, his rise to TikTok fame, and what it's like running your own close protection agency. It's going to be a good one.
From what the paramedics told us, that he was gone for a period of time. That was intimidating. That was quite scary. And I definitely wanted to get a bulletproof vest after that. The very first video that we uploaded and did has now got over 30 million views.
I don't think many people realise that that's the case, that you're all linked up on radios.
And suddenly, and this was a few years ago, the gentleman had a heart attack in the middle of the pub. And obviously that was the first time I was dealing with it.
So Mark, first of all, thanks for being here.
Absolute pleasure.
Yeah, well, should we dive into it, should we?
Let's go.
So, you've been in the security industry for, what, over 11 years now?
Yeah, so this would be my 11th year now.
11th year.
Yeah.
So what made you actually start working in security?
I mean, it was a bit of a push from my ex-partner. She actually worked as a duty manager at a venue in Wolverhampton, the Civic Hall, which is now the Halls. So she was duty managing shows while I had my, I was personal training. And I suppose I was putting a bit of size on, trying to look a bit better, a bit healthier. And I think it was her that mentioned, why don't you think about, getting your door badge? And I knew nothing about security, really. I'd been to a lot of concerts and gigs because of her duty managing. So I kind of just fell into it that way, I suppose. She was kind of, it's that extra form of income on a weekend. I didn't used to go out and drink a lot at that time because my training was everything, I suppose. So that's kind of what got me into it.
And do you remember your first job when you worked? What was that like?
So I worked, it was a band called Thunder, which are an older band, and they did two nights on the trot. And I was looking after the sound desk. Which at the time I knew what the sound desk was, but I had no idea what I meant to be doing there, particularly just stopping people from getting in there. And straight away, I remember having a bit of banter with some customers, one older guy saying, God, I'm not going to try and get through you, am I? And straight away, I felt like, yeah, this can be for me. I'm watching the band. I'm keeping an eye on the sound desk and I'm getting paid. So, yeah, going into gigs and working concerts was kind of my introduction into security. And back then, I had a really, really good team of, let's say, doorman elders around me to kind of learn from and do things properly. So,
yeah. And then moving on from there, you obviously went into looking after bars and clubs.
Yeah, it's kind of a natural progression. And I tell everyone that gets into the security industry that I don't always think it's a good idea to jump straight into doing a busy club or bars, because as much as you get your, you do your course, you get your license, you don't really get any of that hands-on training of dealing with people in a club. It can be very different. Every situation is different. How you handle someone's different. So I always recommend people doing gigs and festivals and even some stewarding kind of work, just to kind of get the feel of what it's like in the industry, when to approach certain situations in what way. So I would definitely recommend people do concerts and stuff as a starting point.
Yeah. And out of all the different roles you've worked in so far, which one's been the most enjoyable?
Most enjoyable? I'd say enjoyable is the door that I'm permanently on now, which is the Wetherspoons in Wolverhampton. And that might sound boring to people. It's a Wetherspoons, but we generally have a great time on a weekend. It's an easy door because we've made it an easy door because of how we get on with all the customers and we like to make the effort with people. And we get, respect both ways. We give respect, we get respect back, and it makes it, honestly, easy. It's not like a weekend comes round and I'm, oh God, I got work this weekend, it's a late finish. It's nothing like that. I quite enjoy going to work.
Yeah, I think the key thing there is having a good team around you. You mentioned your first job you had, the elders you could look up to,
yeah,
ask for advice. And now you've got, the other half of the Bouncer Bros, Tim, who works with you.
Yeah.
So a good team around you is really important.
It's absolute paramount that you've got them people around you. Not only that you can have that banter with and have a bit of a laugh with, but also that you trust. If you've got a busy club and you've got 10 door staff on, say, and you look at that group and, you know, there's inexperience in there, which there's always going to be. Everyone's got to start somewhere. But if you've not got that level of trust together and you don't know where they're going to be at what time and how they're going to react, and it can make things a bit more difficult. So having that solid team in whatever security field you go into is just so important.
Yeah. So obviously having a good team around you is important. But what makes an actual, a good door supervisor?
Communication skills. I think things, if you'd have asked me this when I first started in the industry, I'd have probably gave you the meathead answer of you need to be big, physically strong, be able to get somebody out the venue. That'd be the first thing I'd say, because maybe back then it was a bit more like that, even though things were on the change then. Whereas now, I firmly believe that talking somebody out of a venue should be the only way. If you have to physically get someone out, no one should want to do that. And I think still too many people come into the industry thinking that that is what it's about. It's about authority, and it's not. It's about keeping people safe. It's about making people feel comfortable in a venue and that you've got their back, especially the younger crowds that we get coming out now. People need to feel comfortable and safe. And the last thing that we want in the industry is standing there like Dorman did, you know, when I started and many years before me, just looking like that intimidating figure. We need to be approachable.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. But as you said, times have changed.
Yeah, massively.
Yeah, times have changed. But I think people are still sometimes quite intimidated by security.
Yeah.
Have you faced much, like I said, bias almost? Because obviously you're a big guy,
yeah.
Got tattoos. Have you faced many problems? Do you feel like people kind of almost target you because of it?
I mean, maybe when I first started, because I don't believe my communication skills were great 10, 11 years ago. I think I was very much on the side of, I've got to show people that I'm a big, solid guy, that if you mess with me, then you will be ejected out of the venue, let's say. But nowadays, it's a bit different. And I think it's because me and Tim especially, and a lot of other doormen we know, we communicate with people, we talk with everybody. The youngsters, bless them, they don't seem to be intimidated by me at all. I don't give them reason to either, but I think the younger crowd are just used to tattoos, aren't they? You know, someone having half the face tattooed now, it might still be shocking to some, but to most it's just, oh yeah, look at that. So the younger crowd, I don't feel like they get intimidated anymore by doormen as much, maybe. Maybe some of the older generation might see that and be a bit standoffish. But that's why I try and make even more effort with them people when they're coming to the venue, greeting them, maybe opening the door for the taxi outside for them, you know, putting my hand out to escort them out the taxi maybe on the door, which they don't expect. Straight away, that breaks down that stigma of being intimidated, and straight away they know he's approachable.
Yeah, and going the extra mile as well is always really important.
100%, and we try and do it, and you know, we always say to Tim, it doesn't matter that we're on a Wetherspoons or whether we're on a fancy venue or wherever we are. We always try and be smart, we're always polite, and we always try and communicate well. And that is just the most important thing.
Yeah. And going back to you saying the younger generation don't seem to be intimidated at all. But when you are working on the doors, especially the likes of Wetherspoons, what would you say your biggest pet peeves are that drunk customers do, or just customers in general do when you're working?
Well, this is my top pet peeve, and maybe it doesn't get to some other doorman like it gets to me, but it's when, and it only happens with a younger crowd because I don't think that some have got the etiquette of how to act on a night out. So when they come bounding down the road with alcohol in the hand, say a bottle or a can or something, and they'll come to the door and they'll go to walk in the venue with the drink. Now, obviously, to me and you and to most people and older generations, you don't take an alcoholic drink into a bar, into a club, into a pub, into wherever. But they're not doing it because they want to take the mick, or they think they just generally don't know. And it's that etiquette that's been a bit lost of how to act in front of a doorman. That's not saying when you come to the door, it's a military operation and you've got to stand there still. It's not about that. But a lot just generally don't know how to act. And when I tell them, you can't bring that in here, they kind of look at you like, oh, I didn't realise. Can you have it? And you're like, No, I'm not going to stand with a glass bottle on the door, but there is a bin there. So that's my pet hate when people do that.
Is there anything else that's like an instant, no, you're not coming in, you've just done this, no?
I mean, there's the obvious ones, isn't there? You know, we might have it on the town radio that there's been a fight and we get a description, and then people come to the door, they might have blood on the top from a scrap, drink all down them, clothes half hanging off them. I think that's the other thing as well, that maybe it's a peeve, maybe it's just my standards, but the way people dress now, I wish that everywhere had a dress code. I really do. I wish that everyone had to wear trousers or jeans, smart shoes, a nice top. But it's just, nobody would come out if that was the case of everywhere. Maybe at nicer bars you can do that. But dress code, I just think, sometimes I look and I think, I'm no better than anybody else for dressing smart at all. But sometimes I look and I just think, why have you come to the pub in your pyjamas? And they literally do. And they see no issue with it. It's just, I'm just casual today.
Yeah, take and make yourself at home a bit too literally.
Yeah, and they do, and then they'll put the feet up in there. And sometimes it's not because they're trying to take the mick or they're just trying to just do what they want. It's that etiquette thing that's just not been taught for the last generation, it seems.
Yeah, going back on there, you made a good point about you might hear on the radio from a different bar or club that there might be in a fight or something, and then they try and get into your venue. Yeah. I don't think many people realise that that's the case, that you're all linked up on radios and you're all going to be talking to each other, be like, watch out for this guy's done this, or this girl's done this.
I think with that, with the town radio, I mean, yes, it's linked to the police as well. So if there is a serious incident, you know, we can radio them. But we're all linked, and it's not because we want to patronise people. It's not because we want to ruin people's nights. But at the end of the day, if somebody comes to our door with a really bad attitude and we let them in and they take that attitude into the pub and that ruins somebody's night in there, and then they abuse the bar staff verbally and then they knock into someone physically on purpose, that could cause a ruckus in there. And then that attitude might go to the next place and then the next place. Whereas if you cut out people who've got a bad attitude from the start and they don't get in anywhere, they'll soon realise that maybe I should think about the way I'm acting when I go out. And it's not a case of trying to patronise people. It's not a case of saying you must act in a certain way. It's not at all. It's just trying to get people to act better, I suppose. So as much as the town radio can be a bit of a burden and, you know, you've got to be switched on to what's coming over it, there's always a reason why someone's been put over the town radio. It's not just because a doorman doesn't like somebody. Well, I hope not anyway. I would only put people out over there if, you know, they were trying to use a fake ID or trying to fight with us on the door, drunk and abusive. There's always reasons why people get put over the radio.
Yeah, I mean, it's there for a reason. We want everyone to have a safe and enjoyable night.
Exactly.
Yeah, but let's go back to more positive things about security.
Yeah.
So you've been working as a door supervisor for over 11 years now.
Yeah.
What would you say is your proudest moment so far?
This is like a double one. So a few years ago on a football shift, we were on from early in the morning when Wolves play at home. We were on pretty much all day, all night. And there was a young lad that comes in with his granddad. And he gets quite hot in spoons. You know, I'm always getting the windows open and the other doors open, and he just gets really warm in there. And suddenly, and this was a few years ago, the gentleman had a heart attack in the middle of the pub. And obviously that was the first time I was dealing with it. So as much as I knew what to do, it still gets you. It's still that rush of, okay, I've got to stay calm myself. Let's deal with this properly. Happened the first time. Long story short, it happened a second time with the same gentleman, maybe 6 months later. You know, we got the defib down really quicker than the time before that we got it, because I realised we had another one in town, so I didn't need to wait for the police. Radioed on the town radio, funnily enough. It got run down. From what the paramedics told us, that he was gone for a period of time. But then he came in weeks later, and his little grandson came in and kind of hugged me. And was like, thanks for looking after me, you know, you helped save him. And I mean, the paramedics came. We did what we needed to do, you know, our CPR checks and that. But when the paramedics came and took over, even if a couple of percent of what we did helped, And he's still here now. So that's probably the proudest moment, because it's not that I saved his life. I'm not going to say I'm taking credit for it. It sounds wrong. But if a small part of me helped towards that, then yeah, that was a really proud moment, really.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. So, I mean, leads me on perfectly for my next question. Obviously, you've worked in security. You work in security and you get paid to work in security.
Yep.
But what do you find meaningful working in security besides just earning a wage?
It's going that extra mile for people when I don't have to. A lot of doormen, they just want to turn up, get paid and go home. And you know what? Maybe there's nothing wrong with that. At the end of the day, you are paid to do a certain job. However, going that extra mile, you know, helping someone to get a taxi, for example, you know, a young girl that's vulnerable on her own. I'll give you an example. A young girl came to the pub maybe a year ago, and she was very irate, very upset, makeup all over her, crying, and she'd been mugged. Someone had taken a bag, a phone, everything was in there. She didn't know what to do, and she was in a panic, and she wasn't having a go at me because it was my fault. She was clearly in a state of panic. After, you know, I brought her inside, managed to calm her down, and then I managed to get it out of her that her friends were in a club down the road, which is one of the doors that our company look after. So at the end of the night, I walked her to the club, spoke to the door staff on there that I know very well. We got her into the club. I knew she was old enough. I'd seen her many, many times at our pub. Managed to find her friends, and she was just beside herself, like happy, emotional, again hugging me, because I didn't need to go to the other side of town at the end of my shift when I was back on in the morning to go that extra mile. I could have just said, yep, go to Gorgeous, tell them that your friends are in there, explain the situation. Maybe some door staff would have done that, but I can't. I take the job way too seriously. And the fact that I know I got her there, she's safe, she's with her friends, I know she can get home safe. And then again, weeks later, she came thanking me, shook my hand, offered to buy me a drink. So it's them moments, it's when you can help someone and go that extra mile. Not just in situations on the door when, you know, someone might not be leaving a female alone, for example, or, you know, that's just part of the job. But being able to go that extra little step sometimes, it's rewarding.
Yeah, I suppose going the extra mile as well, it gets noticed, and that's what helps you kind of climb through the ranks as well.
Yeah.
Obviously not doing it just for that purpose.
Yeah.
I mean, it will get noticed.
Yeah, it does, and you know, and not to blow my own horn or anything, but you know what, I know Weatherspoons have had emails about myself going that extra mile before, and you know, the area managers show me emails and thanked me, and the CEO of Active Security that I work for on the doors, you know, he's mentioned many a times that they've had lovely messages of parents of kids saying, you know, door staff don't have to do that, but they really looked after my daughter. And, you know, I've had dads come up to the door and shake my hand out of nowhere. And I'm like, what's this? And they've just said, thank you for looking after my daughter last week. She was scared. She was on her own. You ordered her a taxi. Yeah, you spoke to the taxi driver and says, make sure you look after my friend.
Mm-hmm.
Just little things to make them feel safe. And again, it all comes back round to it just being rewarding. And when you can get paid to do a job that you actually enjoy and get a little buzz out of helping people as well, that's the good side of the industry. And I think that should be talked about more and pushed. The only things you see online nowadays are videos of bad situations happening. And you don't ever see the full picture. You don't know why it escalated to that, regardless of whether you agree with what you saw or not. But you never see filmed the good stuff, do you?
No, you it's always just the...
Maybe that's not clickbait content.
Yeah.
Someone getting a taxi for someone, maybe that's not interesting. People want to see a fight, don't they?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Those are always the videos that go viral, aren't they?
Yeah, without any context.
Yeah. But so obviously working in security for 11 years, you've seen so many great things.
Yeah.
So many positive things. You've done so many positive things.
Yeah.
But you must have seen some crazy things too.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen some pretty bad things over here and abroad. I lived in Texas 6 years ago for a brief period. That was interesting. I'm not sure if you knew about that.
No, I didn't. I didn't. Yeah, so, what were you doing in Texas?
Yeah, so, I got married. Yeah, I won't go into detail about that, but I moved over there for a short period of time. And I worked some bars, some clubs over there. where the SIA license isn't, it's not required over there. There's no kind of governing body. Well, I don't think there is anyway.
No, I'm pretty sure there's not.
So yeah, I got into work over there pretty quick. Within a week of being there, I'd gone to see a club that was opening and, you know, told them I'm available, I need work, and they literally took me on straight away. But Texas is notorious for guns.
Yep.
And I knew this. Mm-hmm. And on the front door of this club I was working, we had, there were police officers, but there weren't full officers. I mean, people from Texas get what I mean. There were like police security, let's call it that. So there weren't full police, but they carried. Now, obviously, I was the doorman on there that didn't carry because, one, I didn't want to carry. Two, I didn't have a carry license, or I didn't want to. But they did. And it always, I remember the first few shifts there, I was like, is this really warranted? I mean, I know guns are popular. And I remember getting rid of a guy in the club, and he was calm as anything. Too calm. And he left the club, and he come back past in a car. Now, whether he was pointing directly at us, I don't really know. Whether it was just more of an intimidation tactic, hanging his gun out of the car, I don't know. Now, I had to act hard as nails, but I remember physically shaking.
Yeah.
And I remember the officers next to me were kind of like hands on the guns, and he went back past quite quick. He wasn't like, it felt slow motion, but thinking back, he probably went by quite quick, and it was an intimidation thing. He wasn't going to shoot. That was intimidating. That was quite scary. And I definitely wanted to get a bulletproof vest after that. But that was the only time I've had that happen. Mm. I've never had that happen over here. We've had knives. We've had people pull knives on us. People come back to the door afterwards with friends in multiple vehicles. Vehicles being drove at us on the door, which has happened once or twice. So that was quite scary. There was a fight a few years ago outside of a club that we went to go and help, and the police were dealing with I think it was New Year, and the police were literally being overrun. And me and Tim looked at each other and we went, we're going to have to help here. Like, we can't let this happen. Like, we've got to, they do support us in the town, so we'll support them. And I remember going over, and there was a female police officer, and she was holding a guy on the floor. And as I've approached to kind of assist her, a guy has literally gone up to her as if he was going to boot her in the head. I've kind of reached over, jumped, threw him away. The officers looked up at me as in, thank you, kind of, arrested him. And it wasn't until the start of this year, in January, that I saw that female police officer again. I hadn't seen her since that incident, which was a few years ago. And she pulled over and she went, you was there that night, wasn't you? And I was like, what night? And she was like, the night you saved me from getting my head kicked in. I was like, that was years ago. She was like, yeah, I haven't seen you since.
Yeah, you're not going to forget someone.
Yeah, and she, you know, proper praising myself up in this podcast, aren't I? But she did. She like put her hand down, she shook my hand, and she was like, cheers for that. Because most doormen wouldn't help us, would they? And I was just like, we're not most doormen, are we?
It's the other, like what we were talking about before, going the extra mile.
Yeah, and that's rewarding as well, because as much as people have this stigma of not liking the police, I've always, yeah, there's issues, aren't there? There's things that we wish were better. But I've always tried to have a great relationship with them. It's very rare we radio for the police for backup or help. We like to just deal with things ourselves. That doesn't mean to say we want to deal with it physically. We just feel like we've got a job to do. And too often that radio is overused for silly incidents, for someone won't leave the front door. It's not a police matter. Deal with it. That's why you're paid. If you can't physically deal with it, then maybe you're in the wrong industry. But when we have needed the police, they respond straight away because they know that if we've called them, we probably actually need them for a police matter.
Yeah, there's a big problem.
And that comes back to the town radio, you know, being overused or underused. There's no real training of what to put on a town radio. There should be. Some of the SIA should insist in cities that there's a bit of radio training in terms of what to radio in, what to look out for. So yeah, hopefully the SIA watch this and take that on board.
Well, for anyone who does want to learn more about radio use, we did actually launch a new security skills YouTube series where we cover everything to do with radios, so people can watch that.
Perfect.
So before we get into about your rise in TikTok fame, I just want to go back to this whole Texas story. Well, about you working in security in Texas, in America. What was the main differences you found in terms of like working and covering a bar in America to here?
Oh, well, I mean, there was more respect for the bouncers.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. That's one thing I can definitely say. And I don't mean this to slam the industry in this country at all. But everyone I worked with at the three places I worked, everybody looked like a bouncer. Everybody looked like an old school bouncer. Even the younger lads had a bit about them, communication skills, or if they didn't have communication skills, at least they looked the part. Yeah, and that's definitely the big difference. There's a lot of security over there, you know, for events, you know, football over there and, you know, all sorts like over here. I just think from what I found that the standard of door staff that I worked with over there were at a higher level.
Really? Do you think that most of them were ex-military, ex-police? Because I'm not sure about the training over there.
I mean, maybe. I mean, if I did an event, maybe just like over here, you know, you'd have mixed standards of guys and girls in the industry. And maybe if I'd have done events over there, it would have been exactly the same. No doubt it probably is. It's just the few venues that I worked when I was like, oh, you know, I wonder what the team's going to be like. Will they have my back? I never had any worries about that because everyone that was sent there, and there was loads of different people that got sent. I was probably the most consistent person at these places. Everyone that I was sent, I'd look at and think, yep, he looks the part. He'll do. But maybe I got lucky.
Yeah. And did you find, was the pay much better over there?
I mean, it was probably about the same.
Yeah.
Okay. If I'm totally honest, there was no real difference. I mean, the cost of things over there was probably a bit more expensive. So maybe there was less room for progression at the time. But I honestly wasn't over there for a long period of time either. So I was just kind of getting my feet wet with it until I came back. So,
right, so we've been talking a lot about your experiences in security. And there's one guy's name who keeps popping up. Tim, the other half of the Bouncer Bros.
The bro?
He's the bro. Definitely. So let's talk about how, well, why you started this channel, Bouncer Bros.
It's all him.
Really?
Yeah. The way it started, he's always been into like content and you know, liking to film stuff. And obviously, I'm a little bit older than Tim. I mean, I'm, what, 36 now? Tim's 28. Tim, he gets the youth a bit more than me. Without me trying to sound really old, but he does. He just gets it a bit better than me. And he always wanted to do content. And I just really didn't know what it was about, if I was honest. You know, I'd always used Instagram and Facebook for my own stuff, marketing stuff for my personal training over the years. So I used to do videos and put a bit of comedy in it. But I hadn't done it for years. So maybe I just weren't comfortable going back into that. But he was insistent that, you know, we can give advice and we can have a laugh on the door. We always have a laugh anyway, so why don't we just film sketches? And I think eventually I was just like, all right, well, yeah, we'll do something. Like, why not? So we come up with the name. I think we fluttered around with a few names and that seemed to be just the one that stuck, the Bouncer Bros. And it just started from there. That very first video, and people don't believe it unless they see it, the very first video that we uploaded and did has now got over 30 million views. And all it is, I mean, maybe people have seen it, but all it is us IDing a group of lads. And the one at the back is the youngest looking one. He's short, he's tiny compared to the rest of his mates. His mates are all waiting by the door, kind of, oh, is he going to get in? I kind of look at him, look back at him a few times. Let him in and they all cheer and go in. So it's kind of just a bit of a funny situation. Is the youngest going to get in? That's all the video is. It's nothing. Yeah. There's no dialogue really or no script. We'd obviously ask the lads, you know, we'd already ID'd them already. For the negative people that say, oh, he didn't check his ID properly. Yeah, it's because I checked it 5 minutes ago.
It's for a video.
Come on. Yeah. And people still don't get it now. They still slam us saying, not doing his job properly. That wasn't a proper pat down. It's like, I patted him down an hour ago. I've just asked him if he wants to do a video. And that's what people don't get about the page. But it was, honestly, it was all Tim.
Yeah.
You know, he really wanted to push it. He controls the TikTok. And this is the bit that people also question me about. I haven't got TikTok. I've got a chat. I started a channel and never posted on it. And it was just so I could watch the videos. But because I don't like reading the comments and people slamming me, I deleted the app off my phone months after us doing this, which was over 2 years ago now. It's a long while ago. And I haven't got TikTok on my phone. And people don't believe me. They're like, of course you have. You're on it. I'm like, I'm on it, but I haven't got it. So yeah, it's all Tim.
Yeah. We'll get onto the trolls in a minute. Yeah. But overall, it's got a fantastic response from everyone. Yeah. I mean, people want to be in the videos.
Yeah.
Most of the comments are all fantastic because you're putting out advice, helping people have a safe night, tips for working in security. It's a fantastic channel.
Yeah, and that's the stuff that I really try and push. Tim loves that stuff as well, of course. But he comes up with the ideas of the comedy sketches and that. And then I try and tie in, well, how can we teach with that sketch? How can we kind of turn it into teaching or advising people on a night out? So our ideas kind of come together with him kind of pushing it a bit more and wanting to do more and more content. That's the stuff I get, you know, that's really rewarding, helping people, especially when, you know, I'll give you a little story. For example, a young guy, maybe 6 months ago, he come and spoke to us on the door and he went, oh, cheers for that video and that you did. And me and Tim were like, which one, bro? There's absolutely loads. He goes, oh, he was advising like girls on nights out to pre-book the taxis. And I was like, well, yeah, no, it's something we tell people. He goes, yeah, yeah. Because I'm always worried about my missus going out. But I don't worry as much anymore because I get to watch your videos. So yeah, and he went, and that was it. And I looked at Tim and I thought, that's why we do the channel.
That's what it's about.
It's not because I want fame out of it or money or just to make people laugh. Like when that happens, when I've made a young lad feel more comfortable about his partner going out and being safe without him being there, it all comes back to rewarding within the job. And although it's a TikTok, it has been rewarding and it continues to be as well.
Yeah. I mean, we started working together last year or the year before
It was the year before. Literally right at the start of our whole TikTok journey. Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, I stumbled across your channels, saw the way you were doing these videos and the fantastics. I was like, let us see if we can work together and create some videos for us.
I think we're at around 5,000 to 10,000 followers then, and it's over 200,000 or something, whatever. I don't know. I don't even look.
So. Yeah. That's not my job.
It's Tim's job.
Yeah. So, but then going back to the trolls, there's always people with negative comments.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
So when we first started, I always felt the need that I had to read comments and I had to reply to everybody and engage with people. And that's why I set my own channel up without posting at first. You know, I had my channel and it was literally just to watch our videos, to see what the interaction was, see what people liked, see what people disliked. And for every 100 nice comments that were nice, there'd always be that one. But that one would always stick in my head. It'd affect me. And I don't know why, because I don't let things affect me. But it would. And after a while of doing video after video, and maybe it's because I am different looking, maybe it's because of the tattoo, maybe it's because I'm quite outspoken with my opinions, maybe. I felt like Tim doesn't get that stick as much. But whereas I seem to draw quite a lot of stick. I mean, sometimes it's funny. I mean, the one comment on one of the videos was, he looks like his son's Crayola'd over his face. And that was just, oh my God, I was like, that's brilliant. I was like, I'm going to use that myself.
Yeah.
He looks like he's slept on a newspaper. That's a good one. So when them comments are like that, I'm like, come on, bro. It's quite funny.
You've got to laugh.
And I don't mind them ones because they are funny.
Yeah.
But it's when people call you out and they're like, we know where you work now. And it's like, yeah, Wetherspoons, Wolverhampton. I'm not calling them out. I'm just reiterating the point of, we're filming at a venue. You can see where we are. We're from Wolverhampton. We've said that in the paper. We say that on our channels. And yeah, if people feel the need to kind of call me out, especially. And they don't know me. And if they turned up to the door being all aggressive, I guarantee if they just calmed down for a few minutes and chatted to me, I'll grab them a coffee and we chatted, I guarantee every single time without fail, they would leave shaking my hand, realising he's all right.
Yeah.
He's got a tattoo on his face, but he's all right. So after months of reading the comments, this is why I deleted it off my phone. And I stopped reading comments. And the only time I ever heard about negative comments is when customers might say, oh, did you see that comment about you? Did you see that? I told Tim not to tell me. If there's something really positive and help somebody on a night out, then let me know. But I had to come away from all that because at first it was just funny. Then it started irritating me. And then at times it'd get to me a little bit. And it'd make me question, why am I doing this? I don't need to be famous. I don't want to be. Even when people say it now, oh, what's it like being famous? It's the most cringy thing to answer. Because I can't go, yeah, I'm famous. Because I'm not famous. I've just done some videos on TikTok that have done really well.
Yeah.
But how am I meant to answer that? Am I meant to go, oh, no, I'm not. Or, yeah, I am. Am I meant to agree with them or disagree with them? But often what I do is stand there and just go, yeah. And I don't know what to say because it makes me feel uncomfortable for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, just keep what you're doing because the videos are brilliant.
I appreciate that.
And I'm sure there's more to come as well, isn't there?
Yeah. But it is, it's become a bit more difficult to film. And a few people have asked us that, why don't you film as much anymore? And it's not particularly because we don't want to, because we like putting out content. The problem that we find now is because everybody knows what we're doing. And we're often filming when we're at work. Sometimes we do things afterwards when there's no customers there. And that's easy to film. But when we're doing the interactive stuff with customers that people love to watch, and those are the videos that seem to do really well in terms of views and shares and everything. While we're filming, everybody wants to get involved, which is lovely. It's great that people want to be in the videos. But then people will jump in the camera and then swear on camera.
Ruinous, yeah.
And then we'll have to start again. But then we need to ID someone because we're at work and we've got a job to do at the end of the day. We're not being paid to stand there to do TikTok. We are being paid to do our job, and we don't like to take the mick out of Weatherspoons. We appreciate that they love the videos. They love us doing it. However, we don't take that for granted. We've got a job to do as well. So it's become quite difficult, especially the last, let's say, 6 months, to actually film real content because of everybody wanting to get involved. What the answer is to that is I don't want to turn around to people and say, right, everybody here, just be quiet for 5 minutes because...
You're ruining their night out as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I'm ruining their night, and I've got no right to tell people on the street to keep their mouth shut, like who, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's become more difficult, but we do continue to want to try and keep helping people. So I suppose it's about finding that balance going forward.
Yeah. And going back to your bromance with Tim, how did that start?
We started on quite a troublesome door together around the corner, the Billy Wright in Wolverhampton. And it's a typical, you know, Wolves pub. It's got its issues now. But we started on there together, and that was 6.5 years ago, maybe. Over six years ago. So that's how we first started. And obviously Tim being a lot younger than me, he was, you know, very young then, you know, in his early 20s. And I don't think he'll mind me saying, you know, he was nowhere near as mature as he is now. We still have a laugh, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I like to think that, you know, I'd been doing the doors for a few years by then, and I'd learnt off some really good guys. So I really felt like I knew what I was doing. I knew how to kind of calm people down, but with that physicality as well. And the good thing is about Tim is that he's a big guy and he's strong. So we can physically deal with stuff. And I just feel like over time, we've both bounced off each other. I've learned things off him that I probably didn't expect that I was going to learn off him. And I'd like to think he's learned, you know, some valuable skills off me as well. So when we moved off there, we kind of moved together. He didn't move over to Weatherspoons the same time as me because he had plenty of work on other doors and he had his day job. So I spent the first probably a year just over with another door woman at the time who was on there. And then when she was leaving to move up north, and it was just the perfect opportunity for me to get somebody consistent, someone that I trust, someone I've worked with before, someone I know that's going to be good with the customers. I can't remember whether it was more me that kind of pushed our company to say, look, I want him. Like, get him off the other doors. I want him here. It might have been. And maybe it might have been a bit of him as well. I want somewhere consistent. I don't want to work Pop World one night, Bohemian one night, another club the other night. And then we've been there for 6 years, pretty much. Well, I've been there six, he's been there about five.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Nice. So we've talked a lot about your journey as a door supervisor.
Yep.
But recently, well, you've set up your own close protection agency, Ironborn. Ironborn Close Protection.
That's the one.
So what made you, firstly, before we get into the agency, what made you make the move into close protection?
I think with CP work, it's kind of like a natural progression from doing the doors. We've talked about going that extra mile for customers as a door supervisor, and that's what I'll get a reward out of. And I suppose it came down to, how can I earn more money in the security industry, being able to go that extra mile? How could I look after a family, for example, or be responsible for, let's say, like a security nanny, let's call it, so people can understand how it works sometimes. How can I give more to people? How can I go that extra mile and be rewarded for it via pay and a career? Because the doors can be a career if you can get enough hours. I'm lucky that I get, you know, I am looked after. I do get a lot of hours, and that's great. But it's more like a weekend job, the doors, I suppose. Some people might want to treat it as more full-time, but majority of people are working the week and then do it on the weekend, like Tim does, for example. He's got his day job. So with CP, it's more like a natural progression. I've been doing the doors a long time. I felt like my experience warranted me being able to do more in the industry. I didn't particularly want to be doing the doors 5, 6, 7 days a week and have that as a career. I wanted to be able to expand on it. And that's why we both looked at going into the close protection world.
Yeah. And with the CP license, obviously you have to do the course.
Yep.
It's quite an intense course, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the course I did was, I mean, it's 21 days straight. I mean, I knew at the time that it was going to be 21 days, but did I know it was going to be such early starts, such late finishes, the amount of coursework and body of work you have to do in the classroom, outside the classroom, all the practical work that we did that maybe other companies don't do as much practical stuff, but the company I did it with, we did a lot of practical work, which was key. I thrive on that stuff. Me in a classroom, staring at a screen, looking in textbooks, typing on my laptop.
No.
I don't learn from it as much as I know I need to have that information at hand. I don't learn from it. I learn from physically doing it over and over again, and then I never forget. And I think that's what I flourished with on the course. The coursework stuff, I struggled. I had to ask a lot of questions. I didn't quite I'm not one of these that will sit there and not put my hand up. Maybe to the annoyance of other people in the room, like, how's he not got there? Why? I will always put my hand up. I will ask, can you explain that in a different way? Can you break that down? But the practical stuff, you know, I felt like I was top of the class, let's say. You know, like I said, I've been a personal trainer for years as well. I've always looked after myself. So all the physical stuff, I just felt so much more comfortable and knowing that this was definitely the right career path for me, because that's how I like to operate, hands on.
And once you got your license, do you remember your first job you did as a close protection officer?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I can't go into much detail about it, but I was looking after, I had a 3-month contract looking after a family, you know, escorting the children to school, business meetings down to London, which was on a weekly basis, sometimes twice a week, sometimes 3 times a week, escorting my client's wife out on shopping trips, you know, due to the nature of having expensive handbags, for example. So you're there as... Yeah, some people, when I explain close protection, they don't know what that means, but it's basically being a bodyguard or being a glorified nanny.
Yeah.
Which I don't mind either way. The pay's good. So, yeah, that was my first job. And maybe I got lucky with that. Maybe it was right place, right time. Maybe it was just from building connections while I was on the course. But that was my first job. So it was like being chucked in at the deep end, although I felt very comfortable doing it.
Yeah. So you mentioned there that you're almost like a glorified nanny.
Yeah.
You'll take them shopping, you'll pick them up and take them places.
Yeah.
What is the average day-to-day for a CP?
I mean, it's very different because there's so many different avenues you can go down. You know, from chauffeuring, from RST jobs, which is basically on site at someone's house or property, which I suppose that's like being a glorified guard. But, you know, if you've got people there and you're responsible for their safety as well, that's when it moves into the CP kind of thing. You've got celebrities that need looking after for boxing events that I've done. You know, business people that need looking after. So I'd love to be able to turn around to you and say, 7 days a week, I'm doing CP and I'm earning this amount of money. And if I was doing that, I'd probably have arrived here in a Lamborghini today. But it's not the case. And I think this is the thing that's missing when people think of doing the CP badge. Is the work there? Yeah, it is about. But it's not easy to get into. It's not easy to build the contacts. Maybe I got lucky with some stuff. Maybe it was just the hustle in me to want to really make this career work, why I feel like I've been, you know, relatively successful so far. You know, I've worked for some big companies and learned some valuable skills in the close protection world off them, which I'll always be grateful for. But I've also got my own client base that I look after as well, that I've been building under Ironbourne. So the day-to-day, 1 week I can be absolutely slammed and it's great. The next week I'm chasing emails, I'm chasing contacts. I'm having to pick up a bit of extra door work to, you know, to compensate that. So like I said, it's not easy to keep it consistent. I could be down in London, which I enjoy. I could be traveling abroad, which is exciting. Or I could have weeks and weeks of chasing leads that actually lead nowhere. I could plan a job that is a week away and there's a yacht involved. And, you know, this is the higher end stuff. And it's fantastic. And I'm chasing a deposit for weeks, let's say. And it turns out weeks later that this trip's not happening. And I've spent all that time planning and, you know, so you kind of have to keep your cards close to your chest as well. Until you're on that job, doing the job, I try and manifest the job happening. But I don't go into detail with people. One, because I can't sometimes. But two, you don't want to embarrass yourself either. But yeah, I can be absolutely all over the place with CP from day to day.
And now you've started your own agency.
Yeah.
Ironbourne.
Yeah.
How's that going?
Really well. Yeah, I have to be very positive on it. Like I've just said, it's not easy. It's not easy. It can be frustrating. And that maybe that's like any industry. And there is parts of me that thinks, you know, maybe I should get something that's a bit more 9-to-5 within the security, close protection world. Maybe that would be easier. But I like the freedom that I've got. I like being able to drop my plans to help a client out. I think that goes a long way, being flexible. You know, getting a phone call, what are you doing in the morning? You know, I'm going down to London, can you escort me? I want to get to Manchester the weekend, can you sort my hotel, sort the cars? My family might be joining me, so could you pick them up from wherever? So there's a lot more to it. You know, you can be their personal assistant. Sometimes you don't need to source anything to do with that. Sometimes it's just a case of they want you as a bodyguard. They don't want you sorting the cars or the hotels. They're quite happy doing that themselves or their assistant. And maybe that's easier because I'm going to get paid the same anyway. But yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned that obviously it's an incredibly competitive market.
Yeah.
Lots of close protection officers out there.
Yeah.
How do you separate yourself? What's your niche?
I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. A lot of CPs, maybe more in America, let's say, to stereotype it. You look at a lot of close protection officers who look after celebrities and they're 7 foot tall and they're built and they're huge guys. And of course, that's one, it's intimidating, so people aren't going to attack their celebrity, for example. And it's not always that the celebrity can't. People ask me, they say, why do people like Floyd Mayweather have security? You know, he can pretty much box anyone's head off on the planet. But it's so he doesn't have to. This is the way I explain it to people. If he hit someone leading up to a fight when he was fighting, that's a lawsuit on his hands. The fight ain't going ahead because he's having to deal with that lawsuit. Whereas if the security throws somebody away from attacking him, someone was about to attack him, no matter what, no matter whether he was defending himself by hitting them back or whatever. If he has a team of not nobodies, but people that aren't in the limelight, aren't celebrities dealing with it, he doesn't even make the paper. No one knows about it. So within the industry, yes, having that physical presence is important, but I'm not particularly tall, but I do look the part. But it's the communication skills that I always come back to that I feel is just so much more important. And that's definitely what I look for when I'm looking for an operative for a job. If they've got that physicality about them, if they're tall, they're broad, and they can chat, and they can talk and communicate, that's the guy that I want ideally. But I'd much rather the communicator than anything else, because often we can diffuse the situations with that over the physicality, depending on the type of CP job it is. If it's a hostile job in a hostile environment, I might need physicality. That might be all I need. Maybe I don't need communication skills as much. But the stuff that I do, which is more corporate, more business people, I need them to be able to talk to the customers if they want to talk. The clients need to feel comfortable. I don't want them feeling on edge because they've got a 7-foot monster looking after them, unless that's what their request. The client's needs have to be matched.
Yeah, sometimes they just want to go under the radar, sometimes not.
Yeah, and that's what I learned from another company, well-known company in the industry. Some celebrities like their guards to look like the friends, to blend in. Maybe they've got military experience, for example, but maybe just looking like normal, day-to-day guys. Whereas other celebrities, for example, might want somebody to really look the part and stand out and be 7 foot tall. So it really does depend on the client.
And when you're looking to hire close protection officers yourself to join the agency,
yep,
what do you look for?
Presentation. That's the first thing. I like to meet people, like face on. I don't like to do video calling and emailing back and forth. I could read a CV all day long and it can be impressive with what they've done, but then that might be, I might get a totally different perception of them when I meet them and chat to them. If I'm chatting to them and it comes across that they're just very arrogant or they're not very good at communicating to me, how are they going to communicate to a client that might be nervous because of a situation they're involved with? The reason why they've been hired, for example, the officer needs to be able to deal with any situation. I don't need him to just be a thug. I need him to be all of the above. Everything needs to be ticked off.
So one thing that I'm not really sure how you'd go about it is, obviously, if you're a celebrity, you want to hire a close protection officer. Where do you even go? How do you even start to try and hire someone like yourself?
I mean, it's fairly simple, really. I mean, I've got my email address, mark@ironbornclosetprotection.co.uk. I mean, everything starts with an email or a message to kind of engage in the conversation. But it goes back to that me wanting to meet people face to face. And that wouldn't be a case of, because I need to meet this celebrity. I could be talking to their management team or their PA, and that's who I need to meet. They need to know that I'm more than just a half-tattooed-faced, bald, doorman-turned CP. They need to meet me, my personality, make sure that I match for the client. For example, a client might not like tattoos, for example. I'd probably not the right person for that client if they really, really don't want someone with tattoos. But reaching out to me can be on social media, can be on email. And like I said, it's that face-to-face interaction with me, finding out the client's needs, what they're after, how many guards they might want. So there's just so many questions that needs answering. I don't jump at every job, and that might not seem like good business sense sometimes, but I always want to make sure that I can deliver. And especially when guys are working for me as well. If I can't pay them a rate that I think is feasible or it's not good enough for them, I've often turned jobs down in the past. The standard of the industry as a whole in security is low. I think, my personal opinion, I think it's quite low. And that can come down to pay. People accepting minimum wage jobs. So when people pay three and a half, four grand to do a close protection course. You can't then be paying them close to minimum wage for being in charge of someone's life, like stopping them, you know, putting yourselves in harm's way, which is more often in CP than in DS. So I always try and keep them standards high in terms of the pay, in terms of what I'm charging. Of course, it's a business and I need to make money from it, but I'm less pushy towards that because I often go on the jobs myself. So if I'm not on a job, I can make money out of people as well, because that's business. But I'll often be on the jobs first hand as well. I'm earning money. My guys are earning money. We're all winning at the end of the day. And that's the way I kind of try and structure the business. Maybe that's not how business should be done. Maybe it should just all be about money and figures. But that's how I'm trying to stand out and be different, being a little bit more personal with it and making sure the guys are paid well, because then I'm always going to get that high standard from them in terms of the way they present themselves, the way they turn up to a job. And there's that level of trust being built. That might take me a lot longer than I want it to, but I generally believe if I stick to my guns and how I'm doing it, it's going to be a big success.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing. Just don't just say yes to every job. If you feel like you can't deliver or the pay is not good enough, don't accept it.
Yeah, and I think as well, one thing I think is quite important to cover as well, people don't realise the costs of security. So I've had people ask me just for DS roles, can you provide guys? And of course I can, because you know, any CPs that I've got the DS badge. I know plenty of DS. And I'll say, well, what's your budget? And they'll send me some figures over and I'm like, is that for the morning? Is that like, how many hours is that? Oh no, that's all day. It's like, and how many guys do you want for that? Because you're not going to get me for that. I want six guys. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think you understand. And then they'll ask me to break it down. And I'm like, well, that's like a quarter of minimum wage per hour per guy without paying me the business any money out of that. So I generally think people don't quite understand the cost of security, let alone when it comes to close protection. So when it's close protection, it's very different. I'm not just stood on a door looking after people. I'm looking after someone's life. That comes with, let's call it danger money. That's why, yes, in the CP world, you can earn more money. But unless people like myself, who's launched a company, don't keep them standards high in terms of the pay bracket, we're going to fall into the realm of where I think the DS roles are going wrong right now. People accepting jobs for minimum wage. For me, a security officer should not be on minimum wage. It's as simple as that. Some people might just be guarding on a gate. Maybe security guarding. Maybe. Maybe minimum wage, work the way up. I understand that. But as a door supervisor on a club where knives are present, fighting, dangerous situations, stopping horrible things happening to young girls or young guys, if you're going to pay peanuts, you're going to get monkeys. And it's a term that everybody understands. And it's a massive problem in the security industry. But if venues aren't willing to pay, and it's all about numbers for them and figures and what percentage, if they're not willing to pay for decent security, chances are you're not going to get decent security. And there's time and time again that I've worked in town on clubs, and they open and they close. They lose the license. Someone else takes it on. They lose the license. It's a vicious cycle that happens constantly. You get venues that a stabbing will unfortunately happen and the venue will close. And the first thing you'll see on social media or the papers is everyone blaming the security. Why weren't checks done? Why weren't they patted down? But when you've got three security guards on a 600 capacity venue and it's full and the smoking area is around the back, but you've not got a guy who covers the back because you've only got three guys. And you two are on the front door because you've got to have two on the front. Insurance. And you've got one guy inside the club and there's no one in the smoking area. And you can get in off the street into the smoking area. Where's that knife come from? Is it coming from there? Was it planted there in the day when you didn't want to pay for security because you didn't want to pay the hours? Same on our venue. We start at 8 o'clock at night. It's open from 8 in the morning. Can we do a full sweep? Do we get everybody out the building?
Yeah,
pat them down?
Impossible.
But if something happened in there, on my pub, for example, who gets the blame when something happens? We do. And I think it's important to put this into this interview today, that people need to understand that no security wants somebody to get stabbed. Nobody. If they are, they really should not have a badge. Nobody wants these things to happen. But often a venue's lack of enthusiasm for enough security or good quality security by paying people more money to give them the incentive of doing a good job. If we could sort all that out, I generally believe there'd be less fatalities, there'd be less issues, the standard of doorman would increase, the respect level from both sides, from a customer standpoint and a security DSCP, would also rise. The whole industry rises. We all win. There's a little bit less profit at the top for these venues, but they don't lose the license.
It just makes sense.
It does.
It just makes sense. It's always been a big problem in terms of wages and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's easy to sit there and say, well, don't accept these minimum wage jobs. But people need money at the end of the day.
And this is why I don't criticise. Like, people will say, I want to get my door badge. And I might look at them thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe this is probably not the industry for you. But I don't say that to them, because who am I to tell them that they can't work in security just because I'm twice the size of them? What, you know, that really shouldn't matter in a lot of cases. It can do, but so who am I to tell them that, no, you can't be in this industry and you can't earn money? I'm nobody to them. I can advise them and help them, and I will do. But everyone should have a right to work in any field of work that they want to. However, I would never apply to be an accountant or train to be an accountant because I'm not very good with numbers. So although I should have the right to be able to do it, I probably shouldn't do it. And it's the same in security. Some people haven't got the right temperament. Some people are a bit too angry. I think that's the good example. Like, people fly way too far off the handle just through something silly. You shouldn't be in the industry. If you've got no communication skills, shouldn't be in the industry. The skills that I think that people need to work in the industry that aren't, you haven't got to prove that you've got that. You've just got to prove you can pass the course. That's another issue as well. But maybe this is things that the SAA should look at more in a bit more depth and detail. Maybe this should just be a bit more structure. Maybe after, in that 3-year period, halfway through, there should be some additional training that is absolutely mandatory. And as much as that is probably going to annoy a lot of people, it's needed. It's massively needed. And I'd be more than willing to help with that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we could sit here for hours and talk about what we can do and all that. But to wrap up, it's been absolutely fantastic, haven't you? But to wrap up, because you have set up your own agency, your own security company, what advice would you give to people with thinking about doing the same, whether it be a CP company or just a normal security company? So I feel like a lot of people have this ambition.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it depends whether someone's been in the security industry for a long time in the first place. If you have done and you feel like it's a natural progression, of course, going into close protection is a great way of progressing. There's also people that have never done a door in their life that go and do the CP badge and absolutely smash it and do really well because they're great people persons, let's say. So in terms of setting their own things up, I suppose it depends if you really want to run your own business and you want them stresses and you want to be chasing the jobs. There's a lot of companies out there that are fantastic, that are already established. Maybe getting your CP badge and going to work for a company, which is what I did at the same time as doing my own thing, because I wanted to gain experience. I wanted to learn off the best in the industry. So maybe doing a little bit of both. Set your own thing up. The way I set my business up is more from a branding point of view. Yes, it's my own company that I've set up, and that's great. But I don't look at it like that. You know, Ironbourne Close Protection, bred from Ironbourne Personal Training, which has been my marketing PT name for many, many years. So I push the branding, which is my business, not the other way around. I hope that makes sense. To stand out, you don't have to have half your face tattooed. You don't need to be jacked. You don't need all these things. But you do need to have a niche. What are you going to offer that's different? Because you're not going to compete with big companies that have got monstrous guys working as CPs, as bodyguards, when you're brand new to the industry and you've got no experience. So how can you stand out? So for me, looking the part all the time, suited and booted, you know, shaven, always thinking about presentation, while I look a bit different, is what I feel is helping me stand out. You know, a lot of door staff turn up to the door, for example, and just, I look and I just think, just polish your shoes, like, just little things, you know, neating your shirt up, like, just present yourself a little bit better. And in the CP world, that's really, really important. And it's what I've been taught, to be fair, and it was pushed on me. Standards in CP is absolutely everything. And, you know, I've made mistakes already. There's jobs I've done that I could have done better. You know, comments have been made afterwards where I'm like, oh God, I should have been there. I should have done this better. I should have. But I'm learning. I'm constantly learning. On the doors, there's not much you can teach me now. But in the CP world, I am pretty much brand new to this. Lucky that I've got my own clients that I look after, and I'm very grateful to all of them for trusting in me when I'm so new to it. But like I said, I felt like it was a natural progression for me. So anybody looking to go into it, set your own thing up. Try and be that little bit different. Don't just mimic another company. Set your own niche, but also try and do some work for other companies. If it does mean that you have to do things for a little bit less, just make sure, you know, you don't undersell yourself. Make sure you're not going back to that, you know, doing things for nothing. You do have to pay your dues, and I get that, but you have to value yourself. How is a company or a client ever going to value you if you don't value yourself?
Yeah, it's pretty good advice. I suppose just learn from every experience.
Absolutely.
Every experience.
Every single job I've done in CP so far, I've learned something different. I've had the chance to work with some really good operatives, some people that look after people that every single person on the planet would know in terms of celebrities. And I've worked with these guys that look after them people or have looked after them. And even just a conversation in the hotel room at the end of the night of advice, I ask questions. I ask a lot of questions. And it's because I want to learn. It's not because I want to pry on how they do things and I want to be like them. I'm just an open book, especially when it comes to CP. So if I've done something wrong, I don't want to stand there saying, but this, but that. Yeah, but I did it. Doesn't matter. Because if that's the right way to do it, then I want to learn from that. So always ask questions, be an open book, take things on board. Even if you don't agree, maybe that's what the client wants. Doesn't matter what you want sometimes. It's about the paying clients and the customers.
No, that's brilliant. And thank you so much for your time today. We've covered literally, well, so much, everything from door supervisor to close protection. So yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Look, anytime. It's been an absolute pleasure. I love talking about the industry. You know, I'm passionate about it. I'm passionate about delivering a good service, both in DS and CP. And honestly, it's been great just sharing my experiences and thoughts.
Yeah, thanks again. So if you are interested in learning more about the Close Protection course, I'll put links in the comments below. And if you're interested in learning more about Mark's journey, the Ironbone Close Protection, potentially even working with him, we'll put his contact details down below as well. But thanks again for watching, and we'll see you on the next one.